session number 17729, rule 6.
Rule 6.
I had this cataract of the right eye, and the doctor who operated was a Maltese. He knew about my service through some documentation, and he explained this business regarding the critical sight was getting no better, and all that kind of carry on. It went on from there. Now, this year, I needed a hernia operation, and it was all done within rather speedily. And during that time, I had x-rays, but they wanted an extra x-ray. I was going to have what they call an epidural type of operation where they just freeze the bottom of you. So you're awake to everything. The same as when you're awake to the cataract. It was when I went for the second x-ray, then the third x-ray, and then the fourth x-ray on the next day before the operation. I should have gone down to half past one. They suddenly found out I had a shadow on the lung, which turned out to be a growth. And apparently I've had that for years upon years upon years. I've always had this cough. I took it to be a nervous cough. At one time, when I went into Muswell Hill Nursing Home under Professor Noel Edkins, I had the cough then. And he introduced me to a pipe. And at that time, the tobacco to smoke was Balkan Sobrani. Inside was a caption, sit down to a long, cool smoke and knock the edges off this jarring world. This smoke is made for a man who appreciates it, and that is me. But at that time, it was 2 and 3 a tin. And that was 1946, and 2 and 3 for a tin of tobacco was like a little fortune. It was only when I was posted to Germany and going aboard the troop ship from Harwich to Hook of Holland, I went downstairs to the mess, the officer's mess, where the tobacco there was 9 pence a tin. I remember buying 10 tins, you know, I couldn't believe my luck in case they'd run out of it. I carried on smoking when I came out of the RAF. I joined the Methodist Church, which I'm still a member of, and I run the football and the cricket and everything else, and I carried on smoking until I got to go off the stem. And I still had the problem, and I had to go up to the ear, nose, and throat. Where they found I had what they called a relaxed throat, and they told me to stop it. Stop smoking, so I did. But I've had it all the way through. I've never been able to get rid of it. No matter what I do, I just can't stop it.
But I'm trying to relate your health problems to the war. It sounds from what you've said that your nervous problems didn't occur whilst you were actually on operations.
No. Let's explain as far as operations is concerned. Everybody in aircrew seemed to carry a talisman with them. Some lucky charm or something, you know. If they'd done something with it, you know. Well, I don't remember. Some used to have teddy bears in a cockpit and lamb's foot and this business. And if they put a white sock on one day and a black sock on, had to go on operations. Well, and they found they were flying with a white sock and the black sock on the other side, that kind of thing. Well, they'd carry on doing that kind of thing. Irrespective of how silly it looked, they'd do that kind of thing. There were little omens they took part with them and so on and so forth. Now, in our crew, it wasn't like that. The one thing is, we were no different than anybody else. But the fact we'd been through so much together and so many things and so on and so forth, it wasn't a time to complain about nerves. In the RAF, if you were on bombing raids over Germany and you decided that you were afraid and you went to the CO to be and you were afraid, if you were a sergeant or a flight sergeant or a warrant officer, you were stripped of your rank and brought down to an AC1 and your brevet was taken off you. Make no mistake about it. And across your records was the words LMF. Lack of moral fibre, and that followed you all the way around. On Heckendorf's crew, the chap who went down over Hamburg, his navigator, he was a flying officer, and his wife had got on his nerves that much that he packed up flying over Germany. They left him on the station for a fortnight and made him orderly officer, and everybody knew that was flying officer so and so who packed up and so on and so forth. But unluckily for him, he packed up in the November, in the beginning of December, And within a fortnight, his crew, five of them were all killed over Germany and two were taken prisoner. Now, he was white as a ghost. He was in a terrible state. And eventually he was posted off to another station. But when he got to another station, his records would be there. And he was posted because there was LMF. His crew was killed within a fortnight of him packing up. Well, when you reflect on it, he done himself a favour in some respects.
But what had his wife got to do with it?
Well, she brought pressure on him that she couldn't choose to come up and stay at Lincoln. A lot of wives came up and stayed in Lincoln and stayed in hotels and boarding houses. Did you know there was an awful lot of the lads, when you're on operations, you couldn't bring your wife up or you couldn't get allowances. But if you were on like a base station like Waddington doing staff duties, you could bring them up and get a living allowance and so on and so forth. But a lot of the wives followed them, not just the operational crews, but the ground staff. They followed them up and lived in civilian quarters, as well as civilian quarters, and get an allowance for him. Was his wife had followed them up and more or less said she didn't want him to go on operations, that each night she couldn't sleep and she had a nervous breakdown. And I'm sure it must have affected quite a lot of wives like that from top to bottom. My wife, I don't know if she was affected or not, but I'm sure she went through the mill just the same as everybody else. Because every time there's all kinds of songs out of Silver Wings in the Moonlight, Coming Home and a Wing and a Prayer, well, it all sounded like tinsel, Christmas all over. When you got down to the real thing, the aircraft, you could lose stacks of aircraft on the squadron. In 50 squadron, in our squadron, we dropped the highest tonnage of bombs on the target. We didn't lose a lot of aircraft, but we lost aircraft and we came damaged aircraft and some came back shut up and everything else. But you see, on the squadron, say for instance you had a friend and another crew and another friend and you came back from ops and you were having your breakfast and they say, Heckendorf's not back, as such was the case. And so-and-so's not back and he hasn't come back and he's been injured and so on. Well, you know, your own attitude then, whether you were suffering with nerves, was survival. You'd have your breakfast, you were so tired, you were dead tired. You go down to your Nissen huts, and whether you got undressed, I don't know. You'd get into bed, half asleep. You'd be in bed round about, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, round about 1 or 2 o'clock, suddenly be shaking your shoulder, hey, you're on ops again tonight. And that did happen. You could do them on 3 consecutive nights. So by the time you've done your second op and third op, you didn't give a monkeys whether you're suffering with herb or gout or anything else, or your nose had dropped off. You weren't interested. The fact that you were with the same crew and going out together. Say, for instance, when our flight engineer broke his leg at the flights, we got another flight engineer. We got the CO's flight engineer. But he didn't know what we were like. The CO was a wing commander, so he must have been a good pilot. And he came to our crew. And you had a certain amount of misgivings until you welded together. And irrespective of what happened to you, if you sprained yourself, if you cut yourself, you stayed with your crew and you made every effort to stay with them unless you had to go to hospital. And then if you went to hospital, you lost your crew and came with a strange crew. There was a chap called Taffy Lloyd on the squadron. He'd done about 4 or 5 operations. He had a girlfriend who worked in Sheffield and she got on the tower of the building and Taffy went down to 500 feet. They could even read the markings on his fuselage. And they could do that, all that can carry on. They even had the squadron markings, ours was VN. And when he came back, they stripped him right down the ranks and posted him. He's posted for 3 months as an LAC and working in a cookhouse. And he came back, played the piano, wonderful chap, really. Really nice chap, big handlebar moustache. He came back and on his third op, he went for Burton. Now, you could say, well, I'm not going the next night, he's gone, or my friend's gone, and all that. You didn't have time to think that way. The idea is that you were on an operational. It wasn't a case of heroes. It was a case of a crew, moulded together, welded together, and basically speaking, if you went out for a drink, you all went out together. If you went to the local dance, into the thing, you went together. You know, there was 2 officers in the crew at that time. Beddingham was the Biomarine Flying Officer at that time, and Jeff Padgett was the Flying Officer. And Doug Tooby eventually was commissioned pilot officer. But irrespective of that, we all went out together. Some was in the sergeant's mess and some in the officer's mess. But when we went out as a crew. We went the same pub. Never went anywhere else. We went to the local hop, we went the same hop together. We used to come back on squadron bicycles. There wasn't a bicycle there, you'd pick somebody else's bicycle and come back on that. You go back to your station and go back to, and you live for that type of situation. Sometimes you're grounded for 7 days because of the conditions or and so on. The worst conditions to fly in was in a bright moonlight night when you stood out like dog's balls and there's an easy target. But you didn't think of that situation. When you were going on ops, you went up to your flight, you went through the briefing and everything else, you went aboard the aircraft. When I got into the turret, I used to pray to God. I believed in that type of situation. I was brought up that way. If I didn't come back to take care of my family, my wife and family and so on. But hoping I would come back, he'd make something of my life. Whether he did or not, I don't know. But that's the way. That's why we stuck together. We stuck together as a crew because we believed in each other. And I was ill at times, the same as everybody else, because I was no hero. Make no mistake about it. I didn't go around looking for the heroes. I went around for people who were members of crews. And I don't think there was ever a time that I wasn't terrified I was going on ops that night. But you went as a crew and you got in your positions and so on. And you type when you got up in the aircraft, you weren't thinking about my legs sore or my ear sore, my bottom sore, or my nerves are bad. Of course they were bad. But you were up there to do a job. And if you didn't do it properly, you'd let the rest of the crew down. It was as simple as that. And irrespective of how I felt, didn't come into it. It was a case of coming back to fight another day. And you didn't come back and say, well, oh, I'm going on ops the next day. Oh, isn't that great? There's a chap on the squad and he used to come along and say, have they picked sides yet? That's what he used to say. That was the members who were going that night and so on and so forth. And well, you look at the list there where we'd done 25 ops. When I first went to squadron, I used to look on the squadron notice board and blokes are 27 and 28 and 25 ops. And we'd only just done our first hop to Milan. I used to look at them and think, well, Michael, they were bloody heroes. But once you got up that far, it didn't matter that way. And when we went on our 30th trip, we said, well, after this one, we were terrified that night because we could have easily not, you know, we could have come down that night more than any other night. But when we did come back, the flight engineer who eventually came back to our squadron said he saw us come out the aircraft that night and he looked as if we'd gone through the gates of hell. We'd gone through so much.
What happened on that last raid? Because you haven't described it in detail.
When we went into the target, we had a mag drop on the starboard outer for some unknown reason, and so on and so forth. And then eventually the engine, it just went on fire, and the skipper feathered it, and eventually it went out. But as we came out of the target, the starboard inner was shot up by a fighter. And we lost that engine, and that went on fire. And then we dropped our bomb loads, so we had to lose height to two engines. You couldn't stay any that kind of thing. And as we came over the German border, we were down to about 6,000 or 7,000 feet, and the flak was hellish, and so on and so forth. And the scarecrow went up, which light illuminates the sky. And a couple of fighters came in and so on and so forth. And we didn't think we were going to come back that night at all. We came back about 2 hours late. When we got back to the aerodrome, they're all gone. There's only each aircraft had their own ground crew. They were just waiting for us.
Careful, because you've got the mic on. No.
There's a citation of the skipper there. That's when he got a DFC in bar within 3 days of the last trip. He got a DFC, we went out one night, and he got his bar within 3 days.
And it was a scarecrow that had partially blinded you on a previous...
In the right eye, yeah. But you see, it didn't affect me all the way through. I just know that I had the blur in the right eye. But, you know, after trips over Germany, you were lucky if you were sensible. Yeah. It doesn't follow that we're all crackers. You got to reflect on the fact that some of the trips were anything from 6 hours up to 8 hours and sometimes 9 hours. The concentration took part when you crossed the English coast, going over the French coast and into Germany. It was total concentration. And you never knew when you were going to be attacked from the port quarter, the starboard quarter, underneath, or anything else. You never knew what was going to happen over the target or what the flak was like. The skipper, basically speaking, was in full command and so on and so forth. The navigator, I don't think he saw a lot of the actual bombing. He didn't, because where he'd done his navigation, he was completely shrouded in. You know, there wasn't much activity. The person, the bomb aimer in front, the flight engineer, the pilot, the wireless operator, he was in his set, so really speaking, I don't think he knew what day it was, because he was enclosed looking after his set and listening for messages from group. If he wasn't doing that, they were listening to Radio Luxembourg, believe it or not. whereas the two gunners, the bomb aimer, the flight engineer, the pilot, knew all what was going on and saw all what was going on. So their tenseness was from the moment they went over the enemy coast until he came back. And it didn't more or less stop once they got over the English coast, because a lot of our chaps would relax once they got over the English coast. They'd take a flask of coffee and have a drink of coffee, and they were shot down by enemy fighters, because the fighters used to follow them in. And you come into land in your own station, and you could be followed in by night intruders, because that happened at Skellingthorpe, that happened at Waddington. So where you were relaxing to go in, and you'd arrived, they were getting shot up while you went in. So it was there all the time, and it wasn't a case of like coming back and saying, well, we've done that, that's a week work done, we'll go back to bed and relax for a week. You could go in back to your nesting huts, 3 or 4 in the morning, 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock sometimes, and then you'd had your breakfast, you'd been in bed, dog-tired, you were white, you were disheveled and not shaven and all that kind of carry-on. Then somebody's shaking you on the shoulder, say, come on, get up, you're on ops again. Because before you went on ops, you took the aircraft on what they call an NFT, and you made sure that everything was working aboard it and all this kind of carry-on.
What does NFT do?
Fights or something like that. I don't know what it's called, something like that. But it didn't happen all the time. But aircraft were taken up to make sure that everything was working order and all that business, you see. Because a lot of our chaps, they did come back with mag drops on the engine. It was just an excuse. Some did come back with proper excuses. But on the whole, there was an awful lot of... When you went over the channel, you could see lots of flashes going on. So they'd drop the bombs and so on and so forth. Until they brought out this thing that as you dropped the bombs, it triggered a camera, which took a photograph and so on and so forth. This is how we come to get this citation for the aiming point when we went over Madain.
But you were telling me that you had nightmares after the war. Was it about operations?
Well, I used to have an occurring nightmare, and I still have it, funny enough. I've had it for years. You might say I was a nervous child as a boy, but eventually I was passed for aircrew, and the aircrew medical was the most stringent thing I've ever known, really. If you got through that, you knew you were okay, really. And a lot were failed on the medical. But after the war, it wasn't long before I started to have nightmares. I had the same reoccurring dream. You know when you go to the toilet to pass water? Well, I could be in town walking with my wife, you know, going through, you know what a dream's like. You go through the proper thing. And I'd suddenly open my fly and pull me Jimmy Riddle out because I wanted to pass water. And I would pass water and people would be walking around and I'd be doing it all. I could be on a stage or somewhere. I could be at home and I'd just do it on the floor. I'd dream that situation. And you know what happened when I woke up? The bed would be soaking wet. So I had to wear rubber things underneath and all that business. And then I took on board nerves affecting me in so many ways. Long before my wife died, I took on this business where I used to eat for comfort and eventually make myself set purposely, because I was about 17 now, stone. And when my wife took on board gallstones and hyperthermia, and then I found out that she had multiple myeloma, which was cancer of the bones, and they said she would live 4 years provided she had the radiotherapy, chemotherapy and everything else. I was still working. It became more intense, and it carried on 10 years after she died. And funny enough, I get bouts of it. I still get bouts of it. Where something goes wrong, I go into the well, living on your own doesn't help. I have a friend called Joan Minton. When I have the operation, she comes round and looks after me. She's the daughter of this Mr. Roberts, who was in the Royal Navy as a diver. She ensures that I get up the right time, I get washed and shaved, I get a proper breakfast, I get a table morning, I get a proper lunch, a snack lunch, I get tea in the afternoon, I get a proper meal of a night time, and I go to bed the right time. She makes sure that happens. She goes in the front room, I go in the other room. It's as simple as that. Single bed there, twin beds there. When she's here, I haven't got a problem in the world. And there are times when I can go 3 and 4 months and I don't have a problem in the world. I'll have the problems insofar as the sight's concerned, but insofar as nerves, they just won't happen. Then all of a sudden, something will happen, something triggers it off, and I go on about to that type of situation. But if there's anybody, if my daughter comes home from Italy and stays with me, she comes for 11 and 12 days, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. But when my wife was like that, it used to happen all the time. It used to go on 3 and 4 times a day and all. Mm.
Could I just ask you one final question? You said about these atrocities of the executions that the Hitler Youth carried out on some RAF aircrew they got hold of.
Yeah.
And yet, when you were talking about the Liverpool Blitz, and I asked you, was there any hatred of the German air crews, I didn't get the impression that there was. Why should there be a difference between the two?
Well, insofar as the air crews were concerned, I mean to say, insofar as the air crews of Germany are concerned, I didn't know they were, you know, the fact the bombers come over here. Now, we knew they were flown by somebody. But we'd never been face to face with a German. We'd never been more or less into their country and so on and so forth. When the planes were flying over here, I didn't know if there was just a pilot on board, a bomb aimer. It was only when I'd been in the RAF and took part in the raids that I knew the Germans.
But if they had been shot down over Liverpool and captured, would they have been treated atrociously?
No, no. I think I'm not being disrespectful when I say this to you. The real German pilots, the Air Force, the real German soldiers, the real German Navy, once they had a job like us to do, they were on the whole, I'm not saying they were good guys, but they were possibly professionals like ourselves. There was a job to be done. I came across a lot of Germans through my job in Germany, and I come across a lot of RAF types, German Flieger Corps, which is their air force, or the naval types, mostly German Flieger Corps and German, the actual soldiers themselves, and German Navy, submarine people and all that, because we came in contact with them. And they had a job to do like we did. The Hitler Youth, they were the Nazis. I don't think you can brand all Germans as Nazis at all. I'm not pro-German, and I'm not anti-German. If the Germans had come down, and they come down in this country, if the Germans had been shot down and I'd have gone along to say German, I'd probably have been terrified. I was 18 and 19 years of age. I didn't have a pitchfork in my hand to take them prisoner. If they'd have walked along the street, you didn't want to shoot them or do anything to them and all that kind of carry-on. It was more or less, well, there's a German, hey, there's a German. Something like that. Isn't that amazing? There's a German shot down. But you see, there was saturation bombing in this country insofar as Coventry was concerned and London was concerned. But you see, our bombing, we obliterated Hamburg. That's an awful thing to say, we obliterated Hamburg. I've got a bloody cheek to talk that way. But that's what we did. It's all right saying saturation bombing doesn't necessarily mean military targets. The thing to break is the morale of the people. That wasn't my contention. That was the contention of the likes of Harris. It was the Air Chief Marshal Harris and people in Bomber Command. Remember the what was the raid where the China Dresden? Now Dresden was the reckon was brought about because the Russians wanted the push and Churchill wanted it this way, but Harris got the blame for that. But really speaking, we flattened that target and there was nothing really there in the first place. And we were, you know, there are times I went on the raid sometimes and thought to myself, you know, I didn't think that way. If they said I was going to Hanover that night or Hamburg that night, I didn't think to myself, well, I wonder if there's an ammunition factory there, or there's this there and that there. Because I didn't think along those lines. I don't think me pilot, we were going on a raid. And you're not going to tell me that if you went to bomb a town, an industrial town in the Ruhr or something like that kind of thing, it's just like here. You had the factories of AV Row and all that kind of routes up there. You had the ammunition factories and everything else. But there's people in between somewhere. There's hundreds and thousands of people. And if I started to think of the number of Germans we've killed, I don't think I could live with it. I'll be honest with you. I just don't think I could live with it. That we went on a job and done a specific job. And, you know, don't get the idea I wasn't scared. I was always scared. If you weren't scared, you were a bloody fool. Make no mistake about it. Because you were under such conditions and such duration of flights. It's all right being in the army, going on patrol. At least you're coming back. We came back on this. But you could go 3 nights on the trot and do 3 raids. And it was intense from the moment you crossed the English coast, going over there till you got back to your station. And you lived in that type of an environment all the time. Make no mistake about it. And if you didn't suffer with nerves, there was something wrong with you.